Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And it is now or never. And that debt is fraud. We'll go through that because I think people need to understand so many things that we hear, we've learned, and we just take everybody's word for it. And we literally have the blind leading the blind today. And so those people who listen to and subscribe to people like Anna Von Ritz or other conspiracy theorists and so forth, you're really setting yourself up because you take their word for it. How many times have you been given documentation that says, oh, well, this treaty, and a good case in point is the very first treaty. We're going to actually go through that. We're going to cover the Definitive Treaty of Peace of 1783, or what's also called the Treaty of Paris, 1783, which was the treaty between the independent and sovereign states and the king. And so we're going to go through that. We're actually going to read the treaty so that you can actually hear for yourself what we agreed to do. Just because the treaty said they were going to do these things doesn't mean that that's what happened. Out the gate, Britain was deliberately violating the treaty. We never complied to that treaty. Is there any evidence of this? Absolutely. Why do you think Britain attacked us in 1812? They were too spent at that point in time in 1783 to try to rally attack. So they decided, well, let's kind of do some recovery. They kind of spent a little bit of money trying to basically crush us in the first edition of the American Revolution. But nevertheless, when we read these things and when we read treaties under the Constitution, don't believe the treaty, even if it is ratified and they're actually following it and they're basically making it the law, doesn't mean it is a legitimate treaty. They had been making treaties for years that were absolutely had no authority in making that treaty. So we'll dive into that a little bit later and get into it more. But let me get through the obligatories. As you know, as I said, that debt is fraud. And in addition to that, you know, our appeal to heaven, you got to pray, learn, pray, and act. We need to actually get things done. So don't take my word for it. As I say, go read them yourself. Get smart, get powerful in when I say power, because knowledge is power, right? Then you have to act upon that. That's when it becomes power, through the exertion of that knowledge you have. So anyway, your campaign begins. You're already behind, but your campaign needs to begin immediately. Now, in addition to these obligatories, we've added one because we want you to start thinking, and I think it's important that we place context to the concept of holding public servants accountable to their oath of office as required by the supreme law of the land. The 14th Amendment, Section 3, requires that every public servant who is under oath must support the Constitution. They do anything other than that. And when it says support, it doesn't mean their interpretation or bogus interpretations. They all have a responsibility of understanding how it was originally defined. Madison was very consistent. We've given you this time and time again, where Madison literally proves that they have to read the ratification debates to understand the Constitution and how the states understood it at that time. Okay, so as we kind of taken care of that, we've already kind of covered, without Tammy, an overview of the laws of nature and nature's God. and the problem with that. And we've also included in that common law and how common law is not anything like English common law in America under our Constitution. And that's because in America, the general powers granted to the government, even today, means that they have jurisdiction over everything that they want to have jurisdiction, but that's not how it plays here. The federal courts only have jurisdiction over those few objects that are enumerated within Article 1, Section 8. That's it. Are those things that arise under the Constitution? That is it. Look at all, go look at the docket today of the Supreme Court. And they're going to pick up a whole new docket. They're going to basically come out and say, this is what we're going to cover over the next year. Go look at the cases, go look at their origins, and you will find out that probably all of them are not within their jurisdiction. They don't care. As long as everybody believes that they can do what they're doing, they're going to continue doing these things. This is why we have to start holding everybody accountable. Now, just imagine if Trump actually did this. I'm not convinced that Trump even cares. I think Trump is basically doing what is best for Trump and what he plans on making these transitional changes of America, basically leveraging off of all of the other progressive presidents that we've had, and continue this line of moving more and more controls to government. He's doing the digital currency. I mean, folks, there may be things that might be getting better. Your kids may not be getting fire hosed with all sorts of, you know, perverted concepts and so forth. There may be a cutback in the budgeting and the actual spilling of blood in abortion clinics. These things are all good, but they're not being done right. For us to do these things right, we need to interpose, and it's actually the state legislatures that need to do this. And it's the county legislators throughout your state that need to get your state in order. So, as we kind of, you know, put this in context, if the Department of Justice was actually retooled to where they were going around and removing people from office and creating the blacklist, in other words, the list that says this person can never serve in office again until 2/3 of both houses of Congress vote to actually remove that disability. And that's it. And I'm going to tell you that as we actually change over the core people in Congress, because there's most of them are all, they're violators. They're a bunch of thieves. It is a... It is a cabal, and many of the state legislatures are the same way. And as I just told a gentleman last night, I said, look, it is far better that we convert and get people on board with doing the right thing that are already in office than it is to try to wage a campaign in, you know, taking them out and replacing them with a good person to do that. Because bottom line, you may have somebody that gives you lip service, they'll sign the petition, and they'll still try to go down a path of doing everything that's better for them and instead of doing what they're supposed to do. So let's get people that are in to do the job. That's the fastest way of getting things done. So with that, let me give you another announcement. We know that the Stevens County in the state of Washington is setting up a constitutional review assembly. The bylaws, just so you know, the bylaws have actually been kind of wrapped up and they're going to be submitted to the Board of Commissioners sometime soon. So we'll be telling you once we actually have a buy-in on what those bylaws are, then we will actually share those bylaws so that you can look at them and so you can start understanding what you need to do. We're creating a template for you and getting people to understand principles and very specific documents that actually help people understand interposition is critical. We need more and more people to get involved. So we're going to be doing a surge of mentoring over these five critical documents. Now, if you go to reclaimingtherepublic.org and you actually look at the academic source documents page, at the very top we have the ratification debates. And right below that, we actually have the five critical documents along with recordings. So you can download the docs. And oh, by the way, if you don't know how to download a Word document so you can save it to your computer, we give you the instructions on, you know, a little bit lower. So just on that one page, go look for how to download. If you don't know, it's just basically right-clicking with your mouse and saving the link or target or what have you. Each browser might be a little bit different. There might be a little nuance, but bottom line, you need to download them so that as you actually go through and play those files, those audio files, you're reading along with it. Do not shortcut yourself. Don't sell yourself short. There is no quick way of filling a sandbag. It requires every sand to be injected into that one way or the other, whether that's by a spoon, whether that's by a shovel. And based on the mechanism of putting it in there, we'll determine how fast it takes to actually get that sandbag, you know, completed and sealed up. But one sandbag does not stop the flood. We have to create a wall. And so there are several documents, and I don't literally mean that we're thousands of documents. There are several key documents that you need to read. Don't take our word for it. If you understand, you read these things, you go through these mentoring calls, you go through this, you'll actually understand what those words meant and why they said them the way they did. And if you do that, then there's a huge difference between, well, GR explains it this way compared to, well, Madison said it, this is what has to happen. And this is why the judiciary has no authority over it. And this is why this is, and this is why that is. Because that's what Madison said. See, now you're building your position on the framers and how it the Constitution was defined and how they moved forward on those stipulations. Well, at least Madison and those who were true to the spirit of the Constitution. We already know Hamilton and many others didn't. Now, as we go through this surge, if you were interested in participating, because I'm not going to bring anybody into a meeting once it started. In other words, you'll actually have to read on your own going through these other calls to kind of catch up first before you even join the call. Because there's no point in having somebody on the call that doesn't know and hasn't actually covered the same ground already. I'm okay if you actually go through all 14 recordings that are on the academic source documents page. You go through all of those, and then you jump into a whole fresh mentoring program. Because if you do that, if you actually do that, then you're walking in already prepared. You're walking in with the base knowledge. You're ahead of the game. And now you can really start asking very intelligent questions because you're actually looking at things and you've already kind of been making sense as you've ruminated and digested and distilled these processes. So anyway, if you want to get involved, just give us a call, give us an email. As if you call, make sure you give us your email. An email might actually be the best way to do it because that way we'll see it, it'll remind us, and we'll be able to engage you directly. Now again, we're going through what we call the definitive piece, or what was called the definitive piece on Monday. This treaty of peace, I should say, of 1783. We're going through this for a very particular reason. Because there are so many assumptions. When you read that treaty, basically you come off as saying, hey, we have to pay back. Now, just be clear here. In that treaty, the clause of having to repay Britain, these were the loyalists that were called Tories they were being kicked out. And so Britain demanded that they be compensated for the loss of property, that they actually write a check and pay them back. Well, that didn't happen. Just like Britain promised not to molest and impress and basically stop our commerce ships going abroad into Europe, Britain absolutely harassed and actually stole our ships and actually impressed our sailors. If you were not a sailor, you had no value to them, then they would basically throw you in jail or what have you in Britain. That began right out the gate. How do I know this? Because when Washington actually became president and they all started creating these policies, standing policies, Washington's intent was to be neutral, but not to be basically, I'll just say, becoming a Francophile or kissing the rear end of the king, because they were already aware of the fact, because they had been violating the treaty. Therefore, that treaty was no longer being honored, which is one of the reasons why it opened the door for Britain to just basically come in and say, you know what, we're going to attack you. I mean, we're going to try to take you back. We're going to try to prove that you can't get away. Well, that didn't work. And so what we want to do is, and what we need to do, is actually start refuting a lot of these bad paradigms. Now, what ends up happening is many people that I work with and or, you know, people that know what I'm doing, they'll send me a link to a video. And the video is basically somebody just spewing, you know, their concoctions, their ideas, the way they see things, and trying to present some case to say, you know, this is why we're doomed. 9 times out of 10, they're making huge assumptions. When I say huge, huge assumptions that those treaties were legitimate, that those treaties were being followed. As a matter of fact, one of the issues that just recently came up is as they were looking at the framing documents of the treaty, in other words, this treaty of 1783, the post-Revolutionary War treaty to kind of create, you know, happy with England, it was noted that many of the people that were involved in the drafting of the Articles of Confederation, the drafting of the Declaration of Independence, many of these documents were being done by people who were called esquires. Now, at that point in time, they may have been called esquires, but this was not a legal system where they were being granted this title of nobility from the king as being a part of that. And so here's the question. If there's no there, then why is it that they're making a point here? Why is it that they're pointing to that title, esquire, and going, ah, that's an emolument. That's a title of nobility. It means nothing to these men other than the fact that they are, at that point in time, lawyers in the American legal system. In other words, they have the authority to practice law. At this point in time, America didn't even have any standards. What they actually started doing was adapting what they had already had. Now, they weren't going to go to Italy and learn law based on civil law and kind of contort and conform to this, you know, Catholic law, or what was now at that point in time being controlled and ran by the Roman Catholic Empire. So as we kind of look at this treaty, and as we look at all this information that is being propagated by all of these framers, you look at these documents and you go, wow, you know, here's the words verbatim. And then they tell you what these things are saying, and you believe them. So who's at fault for wasting time and not understanding how to challenge these things? So what has to happen is you need to learn how to start challenging information as it comes to you. We got to stop taking things as God off, you know, God truths of the gospel. In other words, this is, you know, a foundational document that, you know, that is completely true. We can't do this anymore. Many documents that were written were actually problematic because many times the government started assuming roles and powers, and they started actually doing, like, creating, admitting states into the union with caveats and stipulations that they had no authority to convene or to put upon that new state coming in. It's the same thing with treaties. So when you look at what's being done, the first question you have to ask is this an authority granted to the federal government? Because everything that's happened since 1789, when the states actually sent their representatives to make up the House of Representatives and the Senate, and actually decided to select the president and create the, you know, the executive branch and the judiciary. And so from 1789 on, you have to start asking, where did this actually, you know, did this occur? And did they have the authority to do it? If you don't know whether they've got the authority to do every little clause within the treaties that we're talking about, then you need to know. And at some point in time, you've got to start picking this up. So if you start using our color-coded constitution, I think that is a path that will allow you to start seeing things in a much clearer view, so that you understand, oh, okay, hold on here. Now, we've got this clause in the Constitution, right? And I'm going to kind of do what we've done before in the past, right? I'm going to go to Article 1, and I'm going to go to Section 2 of Article 1, and I'm going to read down in the third paragraph where it says, the number of representatives shall not exceed 1 for 30,000. But each state shall have at least one representative, and until such enumeration shall be made, the following states shall have the following number of representatives. Now, House of Representatives for the people. So the point is this, is that the language here states that it must be 30,000. Is there anywhere here that allows Congress to actually make a law to change that from 30,000 to 40, 50,000 to 150,000 to 500, half a million? No. This is not an enumerated power for Congress to legislate on. These are affixed to the Constitution. You need to understand this for one very specific reason, so that you know what they can write law on. So in the color-coded Constitution we just finished, and oh, by the way, I'm making a note. I'm actually going to open it up now because we're going to get this thing posted over the weekend so that you will be able to actually have the current updated color-coded Constitution for enumerations. What this does is it actually spells out these very specific enumerations with colors. Now, I'm going to kind of give you an overview of this right now. When you look, there are basically three page colors. We use a light green, like an olive green or a military green. We use a kind of a mauve, you know, and we're running out of time. And we use a gray. So these three tones are at the very front end of this. And you'll notice that as you move through the Constitution, when it starts off with the preamble, you'll notice that the mauve color is the base color of Article 1, Section 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and 7. But when we get to Section 8, we actually talk about, well, we'll be right back.
Listen to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so just so you understand, obviously, the green is, this area right here, it's okay for them to create legislation on these objects. And we actually clarified this in the very beginning. And so when you look at the green, these are the enumerations in which laws can be created. These are the only enumerations that Congress and only Congress can make laws regarding that would be applicable to the states and the union. Remember, Congress also has the authority to make any and all laws that they feel necessary in governing the people, the objects, or basically the seat of government, and the territories, and those things that are literally left for them to kind of create rules and regulations until those areas become states, like the territories. So as you look at this, if the laws are made by the enumerations, in other words, any law that's created that has to be, if the federal government is trying to apply a law to the state, then the federal government must actually point this law as a derivative from the object. In other words, one of the objects in Article 1, Section 8 is Congress shall have the power to make and rule for a uniform rule for naturalization and for bankruptcies. So in other words, they can create laws that will set a standard of how states will actually allow, or how the states will fulfill the process of making their citizens U.S. citizens if those citizens so desire. They're not obligated to do that. But to be clear, we're going to dive into this next week. On Tuesday and Wednesday, we're going to go into immigration and where the immigration power really lies. Because you'll notice that they have all of these immigration policies, they have all of these laws and so forth, and come to find out, that's not an enumeration. So in other words, when you look at the INS or ICE, and you look at, you know, these immigration laws, these immigration policies, they're not worth the paper they're printed on. Why? Because they don't have that authority. We're actually going to prove to you coming next week, you're going to want to listen to this. Because understanding the Constitution is paramount. As long as we don't challenge this unconstitutional control over us, they're going to get away with murder. Right? Okay, so this all makes sense. So the fact is this. When they create a law, it has to be within this green area that we've highlighted for you. Now, they're not highlights. These are kind of like the page color. You know, the page is white, but the whole block area where the text is has been given a color assignment, whether it's this kind of light green, this mauve, or kind of a faded red, and a faded gray. The red is the enumerations in these areas cannot be changed by congressional law. In other words, Congress can't make any laws or any changes to this. The only thing that can change the language in these parts, these red sections, the only thing that can actually change that language is an amendment to the Constitution. Is there any evidence of this? Absolutely. Look at the 11th Amendment. The 11th Amendment changed the part of Article 3, Section 2, and the jurisdiction, saying now you can't construe that. The 12th Amendment changed the process of the Electoral College, which was a part of Article 2, Section 1. So when we start looking at the Constitution and you see that base color of the paragraph, then that base color is telling you something. Can they make a law in this area? If there's any changes, when you look at the language here, and we're looking at Article 1, Section 2, I actually have the roles and responsibilities laid out so that when you look at this, you're seeing this mauve color and you're seeing the first Section 1 is being completely highlighted with yellow and green. And when you look at the text up top in the key, in other words, the color codes, these are the clause color codes. If it's yellow with red font or yellow with green font, then that means that these are federal roles and responsibilities. If it's dark green with yellow font, then that means that they're state responsibilities and roles. If it is blue with red font, then that means it is a power that has been delegated to the government, and on these objects of power, they can make laws regarding these objects. Like, they can make laws regarding patents and trades, or I should say protection laws, copyrights and patents, for a limited time. So the fact is, if they're creating patents and copyrights that protect inventors and their products for the entire life of the author, then those are unconstitutional. Why? Because when you go to Article 1, Section 8, and you look at these laws of being able to create so they got the laws of creating the naturalization and the uniform laws of bankruptcy. They also have these things, and this is in Article 1, Section 7, to promote the progress of science and useful arts by securing for limited times. So in other words, if they're going to create a law establishing a copyright, establishing a patent, those patents can only exist for a short period of time because it says for limited times. And the intent, as they talked about the limited time, was not limited for the lifespan of a person. The whole point is in the very beginning of this. To promote the progress of science and useful arts, we're going to allow them to have protection for a short period of time. But we're not going to give them lifetime protection, because if that's the case, then they won't continue to create new inventions and improve things. And we all understand, and everybody understood at this time, because everybody, the framers, read Adam Smith's The Wealth of Nations. And if you go through Adam Smith's The Wealth of Nations, it talks about the importance of innovation. It goes through processes and the importance of safeguarding those processes, intellectual property, those types of things. But more importantly, an open, free market where people can actually start reverse engineering and playing around with what other people do, what it does is it actually creates this competition. Now, you want to protect these inventions for a little while, but you don't permanently protect them, because allowing other people to come along and say, okay, look, we've been able to duplicate this and now we can produce this because it's been a reasonable time. What is that reasonable time? Well, actually, if you look at the very beginning, I think it was like 5 years, 5-7 years. That's it. Why do we have these perpetual patents, these perpetual copyrights? Why? Because it protects corporations who buy and own these things. And they can suppress technology, they can suppress information, and that is not good in promoting science and productivity and promoting the betterment of our society. So when you look at what they can create laws on and regarding, that is the green. Now, when we go to the gray is another area of respecting laws and so forth. Neither Congress or any government, state or local, can make any laws respecting these. So the green is only those areas where Congress can, but there are restrictions. And so we wanted to further delineate that these things are restrictions. Now, when you look at the color code for restrictions, the color code for restrictions is black. It's a black highlight with white font. So anything that you're going to see in black highlights with a white font, you're going to also see this gray shading for the entire paragraph. And so when you go to Article 1, Section 9, you'll notice that that is an area where it is limiting both the federal government, and in 10, it's limiting the state government. When we look at 9, 9 is not actually the gray. 9 is actually the mauve, because that area is actually up for only federal restrictions. In other words, when you look here at the very first part of Section 1 of Article 1, Section 9, I'm sorry, Subsection 1, Subsection 1 says the migration or importation of such persons as any of the states now existing shall think proper to admit shall not be permitted by the Congress prior to the year 1808, but a tax or duty may be imposed on such importation not exceeding $10 for each person. That clause was to basically allow, after 20 years of the Constitution being in effect, after 20 years, Congress can then start creating regulations regarding the importation of slaves and only slaves. So when you look at it, and actually they talk about importation. So technically the states no longer have the ability to allow companies to import or what have you. Everything really shifts over to the states having to manage and control their own immigration policies. We're going to dive into this, like I said, with Tammy, but I'm just showing you that in this section, Section 1, or Article 1, Section 9, and all of these subsections, it's mauve because these are restrictions where Congress cannot make any law to change these. They can't make law to apply these to the states. As a matter of fact, the concept of no ex post facto laws and no bills of attainder and punishment, those types of restrictions are also here, which means that they can't, if they make a law, it cannot be an ex post facto law. An ex post facto law, what is that? That is where something is legitimately legal at that point in time. A good case in point, slavery. Slavery under the Constitution was legalized. The southern states were able to have and conduct the importation of slaves and possess slaves. It wasn't until later on where we finally amended the Constitution and eradicated it with the Civil War, but Congress could not create an ex post facto law in doing that. In other words, they can't come along and say, hey, you know, if you had slaves, you have to pay reparations. We're going to punish you for doing something that was legal. In other words, the concept of reparations is unconstitutional because if it's something that was legitimately, you could do it legitimately prior to the law being made, and now you can go to jail and actually you can be fined or you can have these assessments levied against you because of it. No, that's an ex post facto law. You can make it illegal, but you can't fine or punish anybody. You basically have to say, okay, slavery is no longer capable of being done, and we're moving forward with, you know, freeing all labor and freeing all people. As we look at these things, as you go through these things, this should actually help you start seeing how important all of this is and how you can actually place context to every part of the Constitution. Go, oh, okay, well, shoot, this part right here in Article 2, Section 1 right here in the second paragraph, in the first part of the third paragraph, well, shoot, that's a state role and responsibility. They actually laid out state roles and responsibilities. This is how it starts off. Each state shall appoint in each manner as the legislature thereof. So in other words, the Constitution is telling the states what they have to do. It didn't just tell the federal government what they had to do. For everything to work, the states needed to do this and the federal government needed to do that, or the general government. So as we kind of go through this and we break this down in these enumerated, or I should say, in these color-coded constitutions, one is the violations, and the other is what these lines are. Now, when you look at the blue line, it's kind of a dark or a bright blue with orange font, gold font. That means that that is a standard. In other words, a gold standard. In other words, if you're going to become a senator, then, and this is what it basically says as far as the term of office for Article 2, Section 1, for the President of the United States, right? And so when we look at this part right here, it says he shall hold his office during the term of 4 years. So that's a standard. In other words, if he gets elected, if a president is elected, he will be in office for 4 years, a standard. It's not a role. It's not a responsibility. This is something that is being levied as how it will be. This is the standard. It's the same thing that it requires a natural born citizen. Where do you find that? If you go down to Article 2, Section 1, it's down a little bit further. No person except a natural born citizen shall be. And it also says that you have to be 35 years of age. This entire part is a standard. The Constitution lays out exactly what it has to be. So in other words, a state can't actually say, oh, no, 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 you can be 20 and become president. States cannot even touch that. Congress can't touch that. The Supreme Court can't touch that. The natural-born citizen requirement still stands today, and the definition of the natural-born citizen is the same today as it was then. The only way you can change what that natural-born citizen means is actually having an amendment by the states, ratified by 3/4 of the states, where the states all agree that a natural-born citizen is anybody that was born into a body of flesh and blood. They want to redefine natural to meaning that instead of being born to two citizens of the nation of where, you know, that person is being born. So the whole point is that this enumeration constitute color-coded constitution, the one on enumerations, should help any layman look at the Constitution and understand what these clauses are, whether it is changeable, whether they can create a law on it, or whether it is immutable. In other words, there's nothing you can do other than passing an amendment to make a change to that, period. Because they have been getting away with murder for a long, long time. So anyway, that covers the color-coded Constitution. And we just got that done. We've got that out. And I'll get that up on the website this weekend. So when we look at what else we've got to cover. So we're refuting bad information as we move forward. And this is kind of the bane of my existence, folks. You need to start learning what it takes to refute bad information. So if somebody gives you something and they lay it out and say, okay, here's the treaty. There you go. That's the language of the treaty. So what that means is exactly what it says. Hold on here. Did they have the authority to make that treaty? See, most people think that the government can make any and every treaty under the sun. That, as a matter of fact, it was actually perpetuated as we look at the different citations in the Constitution. It was perpetuated as this idea that there was this ability for the federal government to actually make any treaty that they want, and they would be able to take away our liberties. They'd be able to oppress us. They'd be able to do all sorts of things to us. George Nicholas, in the ratification debates, came out and said, hey, look, that's not true. This is what he says. Have we not seen in America the treaties were violated, though they are, in all countries, considered as the supreme law of the land? Was it not therefore necessary to declare in explicit terms that they are to be so here? How then is this Constitution different from the footing from the government of Britain? The worthy member says they can make a treaty relinquishing our rights and inflicting punishments because all treaties are declared paramount to the Constitution and laws of the states. An attentive consideration of this will show the committee, in other words, he's talking about all those people that are delegates at the ratification debates. He's basically calling them a committee and says, this will show the committee, all of you delegates, that they can do no such thing. The provision of the sixth article is, and so he's going to read it. I'm going to actually read it out of the Constitution. This way, you can actually, hear exactly what he's reading regarding the Supremacy Clause, because this is what it says. This Constitution and the laws of the United States, which shall be made in pursuance thereof. There's no comma there between the United States, which shall be made in pursuance thereof. In other words, the laws which shall be made in pursuance thereof, they must be directly tied to the enumerated objects within this Constitution. If you look up what that is actually saying, that is actually saying that not all laws can be applied to the states. Only those laws that are within those delegated powers. And those laws must be in pursuant to those objects delegated. In other words, they have to be in harmony with the objects. When they actually took on debt, and they wanted to basically create a credit system, they took the liberties of creating a bank. And so they passed a law to create a bank. It was clearly delineated by Madison as well as Jefferson and others during the debates that they could not make that law that they had no authority to create a bank. When you look at the enumerated objects, they had the right to actually, have the good faith and credit of the United States, but that didn't mean that they could go create a bank. That bank wasn't there. So it has to be implied. It can't be implied. It has to be a derivative of the object. In other words, they can take on debt. They can actually pay debt. In other words, pay the credit and or take on credit. They have that capability, but they can't take on credit for anything that they don't have the authority to spend the money on. Let's say they want to spend money on healthcare, and they need this money. Well, it's not an object within the Constitution. So when the federal government actually takes money from China, from Britain, from the rest of the world, and says, we need this money. We need to buy some debt. So you're more than welcome to come here and we'll buy your debt. At top, I will give you gold for it. And this way we can actually have leverage so that we can go spend this money on healthcare. That right there is a double fraud, because the state that comes in that actually allows the federal government to actually take the money for spending it unconstitutionally, that entity, that nation, has to do the due diligence to ensure that the money that they're borrowing is legitimately granted to them. In other words, what they're planning on spending that money on has to be legitimate. If they actually give the government, they give the United States government money to spend on things they don't have the authority, then we're not obligated to actually pay them back. because they didn't have the authority to take it in the first place. They cannot make debt to pay for things that they have no authority to pay for. It is fraud. The fact that they're paying money on something that they don't have the authority is fraud. The debt that they have to take to do that is fraud. You understand? That's why when we look at that debt clock, we look at all those liabilities, none of the money that they're talking about on that debt clock is legitimate. None of it. As a matter of fact, we can prove going through time that we have been actually sending money and paying for credit when it was illegitimate credit and illegitimate debt. This goes over a century, folks. When we do a thorough audit and we actually chase every penny as whether it was legitimate or not, you're going to find that the wars that we have fought legitimately, because we had the authority to fight a war. Now, we may not have had the authority to send the army, to stand up the army and do all of those things. That money was fraud. Because the army is not something that is deployable overseas. So giving the army the capacity and the capability of getting on ships and deploying overseas like in World War I and II, I'm sorry, that was illegitimate fraud or illegitimate spending, illegitimate debt, therefore fraud. It was a double fraud. When we start breaking all of this down, this is so important. This is why we need you to start actually challenging when somebody comes along and says, oh, well, this is legitimate. Daniel, look at this treaty. They didn't have the authority to make that treaty. You have to find, if you can't find the object in the Constitution for that, the source of that treaty, like to submit the states and the union, in each independent sovereign state and the entire union to a foreign entity to govern us, that has to be an object right there in Article 1, Section 8. And it don't exist, folks. So the treaties that we're making with the UN and the treaties that we're making with all these other countries and polities, the World Health Organization, all of the laws, all of the rules that they want to impose upon us is not legitimate. When we start understanding these things, then we are going to become a very powerful people in getting full control and actually restoring our self-governing system. Understanding all of this. So I've got a paper I'm doing so that you can kind of understand how we have to do this. So what I didn't get into today, because we've got to talk about this realistic concepts of representation and realistic concepts of government. Government should never exist if it cannot be properly funded and paid for. You can't create a government to give you everything if it doesn't have the ability to do it. It's just like the Articles of Confederation. So you have to do these things right. Anyway, we're out of time. So as we move forward, we're going to dive more into this, but on Monday, we're going to cover that peace treaty with the Paris Treaty with Britain. I'm Jerry Mobley, Reclaiming the Republic. We need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.